He does not try to understand feelings or deep-rooted reactions she cannot justify. She does not understand what lives behind her husband's pedantic and overwhelming logic. He even goes so far as to become irritated by the ignorance she never hid from him, and challenges her with questions about astronomy. He is flattered, nonetheless, to tell her what to read, to find in her a listener he can easily dominate. In a struggle where her intellectual shortcomings condemn her to losing every time, the young wife has no defense other than silence or tears or violence. Her head spinning as if overcome by blows, Berta could no longer think when she heard that erratic and strident voice, and Albert continued to envelop her in an imperious drone to confuse her, to injure her in the distress of her humiliated spirit. She was defeated, disarmed before the asperities of an inconceivable argumentation, and to release herself from this unjust power, she cried, "Leave me alone!" These words seemed too weak to her. She saw a crystal flask on her dressing table, and all at once threw the bottle at Albert. Sometimes a wife will fight back, but often, with good or bad will, like Nora in A Doll's House, she lets her husband think for her. It is he who will be the couple's consciousness. Note: when I was at home with Papa, he told me his opinion about everything, and so I had the same opinions, and if I differed from him, I concealed the fact, because he would not have liked it. I mean that I was simply transferred from Papa's hands into yours. You arranged everything according to your own taste, and so I got the same tastes as yours, or else I pretended to. I am really not quite sure which. I think sometimes the one and sometimes the other. You and Papa have committed a great sin against me. It is your fault that I have made nothing of my life. Through timidity, awkwardness, or laziness, she leaves it up to the man to formulate their common opinions on all general and abstract subjects. An intelligent woman, cultivated and independent, but who, for 15 years, had admired a husband she deemed superior, told me how, after his death, she was obliged, to her dismay, to have her own convictions and behavior. She is still trying to guess what he would have thought and decided in each situation. The husband is generally comfortable in this role of mentor and chief. Note: Helmer says to Nora, "But do you suppose you are any the less dear to me because you don't understand how to act on your own responsibility? No, no, only lean on me. I will advise you and direct you. I should not be a man if this womanly helplessness did not just give you a double attractiveness in my eyes. Be at rest and feel secure. I have broad wings to shelter you under. There is something so indescribably sweet and satisfying to a man in the knowledge that he has forgiven his wife. She has in a way become both wife and child to him. So you shall be for me after this, my little scared, helpless darling. Have no anxiety about anything, Nora. Only be frank and open with me, and I will serve as will and conscience both to you." In the evening, after a difficult day dealing with his equals and obeying his superiors, he likes to feel absolutely superior and dispense incontestable truths. Note: refer to Lawrence, Fantasia of the Unconscious. You'll have to fight to make a woman believe in you as a real man, a real pioneer. No man is a man unless to his woman he is a pioneer. You'll have to fight still harder to make her yield her goal to yours. Ah, then, how wonderful it is! How wonderful it is to come back to her at evening as she sits half in fear and waits. How good it is to come home to her. How rich you feel, tired with all the burden of the day in your veins, turning home. And you feel an unfathomable gratitude to the woman who loves you and believes in your purpose. Happy to find in his wife a double who shores up his self-confidence, he tells her about the day's events, tells her how he wins over his adversaries. He comments on the daily paper and the political news. He gladly reads aloud to his wife, so that even her connection with culture should not be her own. To increase his authority, he likes to exaggerate feminine incapacity. She accepts this subordinate role with more or less docility. We have seen the surprised pleasure of women who, sincerely regretting their husband's absence, discover in themselves at such times unsuspected possibilities. They run businesses, bring up children, decide and administer without help. They suffer when their husbands return and doom them again to incompetence. Marriage incites man to a capricious imperialism. The temptation to dominate is the most universal and the most irresistible there is. To turn over a child to his mother or to turn over a wife to her husband is to cultivate tyranny in the world. It is often not enough for the husband to be supported and admired, to give counsel and guidance. He gives orders. He plays the sovereign. All the resentments accumulated in his childhood, throughout his life, accumulated daily among other men whose existence vexes and wounds him, he unloads at home by unleashing his authority over his wife. He acts out violence, power, intransigence. He issues orders in a severe tone, or he yells and hammers the table. This drama is a daily reality for the wife. He is so convinced of his rights that his wife's least show of autonomy seems a rebellion to him. He would keep her from breathing without his consent. She, nonetheless, rebels. Even if she started out recognizing masculine prestige, her dazzlement is soon dissipated. One day the child recognizes his father is but a contingent individual. The wife soon discovers she is not before the grand suzerain, the chief, the master, but a man. She sees no reason to be subjugated to him. In her eyes, he merely represents unjust and unrewarding duty. Sometimes she submits with a masochistic pleasure. She takes on the role of victim, and her resignation is only a long and silent reproach. But she often fights openly against her master as well, and begins tyrannizing him back. Man is being naive when he imagines he will easily make his wife bend to his wishes and shape her as he pleases. A wife is what her husband makes her, says Balzac. But he says the opposite a few pages further on. In the area of abstraction and logic, the wife often resigns herself to accepting male authority. But when it is a question of ideas and habits she really clings to, she opposes him with covert tenacity. The influence of her childhood and youth is deeper for her than for the man, as she remains more closely confined in her own personal history. She usually does not lose what she acquires during these periods. The husband will impose a political opinion on his wife, but he will not change her religious convictions, nor will he shake her superstitions. This is what Jean Barois saw, he who imagined having a real influence on the devout little ninny who shared his life. Overcome, he says, a little girl's brain conserved in the shadows of a provincial town, all the assertions of ignorant stupidity. This can't be cleaned up. In spite of opinions she has learned and principles she reels off like a parrot, the wife retains her own vision of the world. This resistance can render her incapable of understanding a husband smarter than herself. Or, on the contrary, she will rise above masculine seriousness like the heroines in Stendhal or Ibsen. Sometimes, out of hostility toward the man, either because he has sexually disappointed her or, on the contrary, because he dominates her and she wants revenge, she will clutch on to values that are not his. She relies on the authority of her mother, father, brother, or some masculine personality who seems superior to her, a confessor or a sister, to prove him wrong. Or rather than opposing him with anything positive, she continues to contradict him systematically, attack him, insult him. She strives to instill in him an inferiority complex. Of course, if she has the necessary capacity, she will delight in outshining her husband. Imposing her advice, opinions, directives, she will seize all moral authority. In cases where it is impossible to contest her husband's intellectual superiority, she will try to take her revenge on a sexual level, or she will refuse him. As Olivier tells us about Madame Michelet, she wanted to dominate everywhere, in bed because she had to do that, and at the work table. It was the table she aimed for, and Michelet defended it at first while she defended the bed. For several months, the couple was chased. Finally, Michelet got the bed, and Athénaïs Mialaret soon after had the table. She was born a woman of letters, and it was her true place. Note, Daniel Alévi, Jules Michelet. Translation. Either she stiffens in his arms and inflicts the insult of her frigidity on him, or she shows herself to be capricious and coquettish, imposing on him the attitude of suppliant. She flirts, she makes him jealous, she is unfaithful to him. In one way or another, she tries to humiliate him in his virility. While caution prevents her from pushing him too far, at least she preciously keeps in her heart the secret of her haughty coldness. She confides sometimes to her diary, more readily to her friends. Many married women find it amusing to share tricks they use to feign pleasure they claim not to feel, and they laugh wildly at the vain naivete of their dupes. These confidences are perhaps another form of play-acting. Between frigidity and willful frigidity, the boundaries are uncertain. In any case, they consider themselves to be unfeeling and satisfy their resentment this way. There are women, ones likened to the praying mantis, who want to triumph night and day. They are cold in embrace, contemptuous in conversations, and tyrannical in their behavior. This is how, according to Mabel Dodge's testimony, Frida behaved with Lawrence. Unable to deny his intellectual superiority, she attempted to impose her own vision of the world on him, where only sexual values counted. He must see through her, and she had to see life from the sex center. She endorsed or repudiated experience from that angle. One day, she declared to Mabel Dodge, "He has to get it all from me. Unless I am there, he feels nothing, nothing. And he gets his books from me," she continued, boastfully. "Nobody knows that. Why, I have done pages of his books for him." Nonetheless, she bitterly and ceaselessly needs to prove this need he has for her. She demands he take care of her without respite. If he does not do it spontaneously, she corners him. "I discovered that Frida would not let things slide. I mean between them. Their relationship was never allowed to become slack. When they were going along smoothly, not noticing each other much, when the thing between them tended to slip into unconsciousness and rest, Frida would burst a bombshell at him. She never let him forget her. What in the first days must have been the splendor of fresh and complete experience had become, when I knew them, the attack and the defense between enemies. Frida would sting him in a tender place. At the end of an evening when he had not particularly noticed her, she would begin insulting him." Note, Lujan, Lorenzo and Taus, translation. Married life had become for them a series of scenes repeated over and over in which neither of them would give in, turning the least quarrel into a titanic duel between man and woman. In a very different way, the same untamed will to dominate is found in Juando's Elise, driving her to undermine her husband as much as possible. Elise. "Right from the start, around me, I undermine everything. Afterwards, I don't have anything to worry about. I don't only have to deal with monkeys or monsters. When she wakes up, she calls me. My ugly one. It is a policy. She wants to humiliate me. She went about making me give up all my illusions about myself, one after the other, with such outright pleasure. She has never missed the chance to tell me that I am this or that miserable thing in front of my astonished friends or our embarrassed servants. So I finally ended up believing her. To despise me, she never misses an occasion to make me feel that my work interests her less than any of her own improvements. It is she who dried up the source of my thoughts by patiently, slowly, and purposefully discouraging me, methodically humiliating me, making me renounce my pride, in spite of myself, by chipping away with a precise, imperturbable, implacable logic. 'In the end, you earn less than a worker,' she threw out at me one day in front of the polisher. 'She wants to belittle me to seem superior, or at least equal, and this disdain keeps her in her high place over me. She only has esteem for me insofar as what I do serves her as a stepping stone or piece of merchandise.'" Note, Bold Chronicle of a Strange Marriage and Nouvelle Chronique Maritale, New Marriage Chronicles. To posit themselves before the male as essential subjects Frida and Elise make use of a tactic men have often denounced. They try to deny them their transcendence. Men readily suppose that woman entertains dreams of castration against them. In fact, her attitude is ambiguous. She desires to humiliate the masculine sex rather than suppress it. Far more exact, she wishes to damage man in his projects, his future. She is triumphant when her husband or child is ill, tired, reduced to a bodily presence. They then appear to be no more than an object among others in the house over which she reigns. She treats them with a housewife's skill. She bandages them like she glues together a broken dish. She cleans them as one cleans a pot. Nothing resists her angelic hands, friends of peelings and dishwater. In speaking about Frida, Lawrence told Mabel Dodge, "You cannot imagine what it is to feel the hand of that woman on you if you are sick, the heavy German hand of the flesh." Consciously, the woman imposes her hand with all its weight to make the man feel he also is no more than a being of flesh. This attitude cannot be pushed further than it is with Juando's Elise. "I remember, for example, Chang Sen Lice in the beginning of our marriage. I really only became intimate with the woman thanks to it. The day Elise took me naked on her lap to shave me like a sheep, lighting me up with a candle, she moved around my body down to my secret parts. Oh, her close inspection of my armpits, my chest, my navel, the skin of my testicles taut like a drum between her fingers, her prolonged pauses along my thighs, between my feet and the passage of the razor around my asshole. The final drop into the basket, a tuft of blonde hair where the lice were hiding, and that she burned, giving me over in one fell swoop, delivering me at the same time from the lice and their den, to a new nakedness and to the desert of isolation." Woman loves man to be passive flesh and not a body that expresses subjectivity. She affirms life against existence, values of the flesh against values of the spirit. She readily adopts Pascal's humorous attitude to male enterprises. She thinks as well, all man's miseries derive from not being able to sit quiet in a room alone. She would gladly keep him shut up at home. All activity that does not directly benefit family life provokes her hostility. Bernard Palissy's wife is indignant when he burns the furniture to invent a new enamel without which the world had done very well until then. Madame Racine makes her husband take an interest in her red currants and refuses to read his tragedies. Juando is often peeved in the bold chronicle of a strange marriage because Elise stubbornly considers his literary work merely a source of material profit. "I said to her, 'My latest story was published this morning.' She replied, without in any way wishing to be cynical and merely because it is the only thing that matters to her, 'That means we shall have at least 300 francs extra this month.'" It happens that these conflicts worsen and then provoke a rupture. But generally, the woman wants to hold on to her husband as well as to refuse his domination. She struggles against him to defend her autonomy, and she fights against the rest of the world to conserve the situation that dooms her to dependence. This double game is difficult to play, which explains in part the worried and nervous state in which multitudes of women spend their lives. Stekel gives a very significant example. "Mrs. Z.T., who never had an orgasm, is married to a very cultivated man, but she cannot bear his superiority and she began to want to be his equal by studying his specialty. As it was too difficult, she gave up her studies as soon as they were engaged. The very famous man had many students chasing after him. She decides not to partake in this ridiculous cult. In her marriage, she was insensitive from the start, and she remained that way. She attained an orgasm only through masturbation when her husband had finished, satisfied, and she would tell him about it. She refused his attempts to excite her by his caresses. Soon, she began to ridicule him and undermine her husband's work. She could not understand these ninnies who pursued him, she who knew the behind-the-scenes of the great man's private life. In their daily quarrels, expressions arose such as, 'You can't put anything over on me with your scribbling,' or, 'You think you can do what you want with me because you're a little writer.' The husband spent more and more time with his students. She surrounded herself with young men. She continued this way for years until her husband fell in love with another woman. She always stood for his little liaisons. She even made friends of his abandoned poor idiots. But then she changed her attitude and gave in, without orgasm, to the first adolescent who came along. She admitted to her husband that she had cheated on him, which he accepted without a problem. They could peacefully separate. She refused the divorce. There followed a long explanation and reconciliation. She broke down in tears and experienced her first intense orgasm. It is clear that in her struggle against her husband, she never intends to leave him. There is an art to catching a husband. Keeping him is a profession. It takes a great deal of skill. A prudent sister said to a cranky young wife, "Be careful, making scenes with Marcel will make you lose your situation." The stakes are the highest, material and moral security, a home of one's own, wifely dignity, a more or less successful substitute for love and happiness. The wife quickly learns that her erotic attraction is the weakest of her weapons. It disappears with familiarity, and there are, alas, other desirable women in the world. So she still works at being seductive and pleasing. She is often torn between the pride that inclines her to frigidity and the notion that her sensual ardor will flatter and keep her husband. She also counts on the force of habit, on the charm he finds in a pleasant home, his taste for good food, his affection for his children. She tries to make him proud by her way of entertaining, dressing, and exercising authority over him, with her advice and her influence. As much as she can, she will make herself indispensable, either by her social success or by her work. But above all, a whole tradition teaches wives the art of how to catch a man. One must discover and flatter his weaknesses, cunningly use flattery and disdain, docility and resistance, vigilance and indulgence. This last blend is especially subtle. One must not give a husband too much or too little freedom. If she is too indulgent, the wife finds her husband escaping her. The money and passion he spends on other women are her loss. She runs the risk of having a mistress get enough power over him to seek a divorce, or at least take first place in his life. Yet if she forbids him all adventure, if she overwhelms him by her close scrutiny, her scenes, her demands, she can seriously turn him against her. It is a question of knowing how to make concessions advisedly. If the husband puts a few dents in the contract, she will close her eyes. But at other moments, she must open them wide. In particular, the married woman mistrusts young girls who would be only too happy to take over her position. To tear her husband from a worrying rival, she will take him on a trip. She will try to distract him. If necessary, following Madame de Pompadour's model, she will seek out another, less dangerous rival. If nothing succeeds, she will resort to crying, nervous fits, suicide attempts, and such. But too many scenes and recriminations will chase her husband from the house. The wife will make herself unbearable just when she most needs to seduce. If she wants to win her hand, she will skillfully combine touching tears and heroic smiles, blackmail and coquetry. Dissimulate, trick, hate, and fear in silence. Bet on the vanity and weakness of a man. Learn how to foil him, play him, manipulate him. It is all quite a sad science. The wife's great excuse is that she is forced to involve her whole self in marriage. She has no profession, no skills, no personal relations. Even her name is not her own. She is nothing but her husband's other half. If he abandons her, she will most often find no help, either within or outside of herself. It is easy to cast a stone at Sophia Tolstoy, as A. de Monzy and Montholon do. But if she had refused the hypocrisy of conjugal life, where could she have gone? What destiny awaited her? True, she seems to have been a contemptible shrew, but could one ask her to love her tyrant and bless her enslavement? For there to be loyalty and friendship between spouses, the sine qua non is that both must be free vis-à-vis each other and concretely equal. As long as man alone possesses economic autonomy and holds, by law and custom, privileges conferred on him by his masculinity, It is natural that he should so often appear a tyrant, inciting woman to revolt and duplicity. No one dreams of denying the tragedies and nastiness of married life, but advocates of marriage defend the idea that spouses' conflicts arise out of the bad faith of individuals and not out of the institutions. Tolstoy, among others, describes the ideal couple in the epilogue to War and Peace, Pierre and Natasha. She was a coquettish and romantic girl. When married, she astounds those who knew her by giving up her interest in her appearance, society, and pastimes, and devoting herself exclusively to her husband and children. She becomes the very epitome of a matron. In her face, there was not, as formerly, that ceaselessly burning fire of animation that had constituted her charm. Now one often saw only her face and body, while her soul was not seen at all. One saw only a strong, beautiful, and fruitful female. She demands from Pierre a love as exclusive as the one she swears to him. She is jealous of him. He gives up going out, all his old friends, and devotes himself entirely to his family as well. Pierre's subjection consisted in his not daring to go to clubs or dinners, not daring to leave for long periods of time except on business, in which his wife also included his intellectual pursuits, of which she understood nothing, but to which she ascribed great importance. Pierre is under the slipper of his wife, but in return, at home, Natasha put herself on the footing of her husband's slave. The entire household was governed only by the imaginary orders of the husband, that is, by Pierre's wishes, which Natasha tried to guess. When Pierre goes far away from her, Natasha impatiently greets him upon his return, because she suffers from his absence. But a wonderful harmony reigns over the couple. They understand each other with barely a few words. Between her children, her home, her loved and respected husband, she savors nearly untainted happiness. This idyllic tableau merits closer scrutiny. Natasha and Pierre are united, says Tolstoy, like soul and body, but when the soul leaves the body, only one dies. What would happen if Pierre should cease to love Natasha? Lawrence, too, rejects the hypothesis of masculine inconstancy. Don Ramon will always love the little Indian girl, Teresa, who gave him her soul. Yet, one of the most ardent zealots of unique, absolute, eternal love, André Breton, is forced to admit that at least in present circumstances, this love can mistake its object. Error or inconstancy, it is the same abandonment for the woman. Pierre, robust and sensual, will be physically attracted to other women. Natasha is jealous. Soon the relationship will sour. Either he will leave her, which will ruin her life, or he will lie and resent her, which will spoil his life. Or they will live with compromises and half-measures, which will make them both unhappy. One might object that Natasha will at least have her children, but children are a source of joy only within a well-balanced structure, where the husband is one of its peaks. For the neglected, jealous wife, they become a thankless burden. Tolstoy admires Natasha's blind devotion to Pierre's ideas, but another man, Lawrence, who also demands blind devotion from women, mocks Pierre and Natasha. So in the opinion of other men, a man can be a clay idol and not a real god. In worshiping him, one loses one's life instead of saving it. How is one to know? Masculine claims compete with each other. Authority no longer plays a part. The wife must judge and criticize. She cannot be but a feeble echo. Moreover, it is degrading to her to impose principles and values on her that she does not believe in with her own free will. What she might share of her husband's thinking, she can only share through her own independent judgment. She should not have to accept or refuse what is foreign to her. She cannot borrow her own reasons for existing from another. The most radical condemnation of the Pierre-Natasha myth comes from the Leon-Sophia couple. Sophia feels repulsion for her husband. She finds him tedious. He cheats on her with all the surrounding peasants. She is jealous and bored. She is frustrated by her multiple pregnancies, and her children do not fill the emptiness in her heart or her days. Home for her is an arid desert. For him, it is hell. And it ends up with an old hysterical woman lying half naked in the humid night of the forest, with this old hounded man fleeing, renouncing finally the union of a whole life. Of course, Tolstoy's case is exceptional. There are many marriages that work well, that is, where the spouses reach a compromise. They live next to each other without antagonizing each other, without lying to each other too much. But there is a curse they rarely escape: boredom. Whether the husband succeeds in making his wife an echo of himself, or whether each one entrenches himself in his universe, they have nothing else to share with each other after a few months or years. The couple is a community whose members have lost their autonomy without escaping their solitude. They are statically assimilated to each other instead of sustaining a dynamic and lively relation together. This is why they can give nothing to each other, exchange nothing on a spiritual or erotic level. In one of her best short stories, Too Bad, Dorothy Parker sums up the sad saga of many conjugal lives. It is night, and Mr. Weldon comes home. Mrs. Weldon opened the door at his ring. "Well," she said cheerily. They smiled brightly at each other. "Hello," he said. "Well, you home?" They kissed, slightly. She watched with polite interest while he hung up his hat and coat, removed the evening papers from his pocket, and handed one to her. "Bring the papers," she said, taking it. "Well, what have you been doing with yourself today?" he inquired. She had been expecting the question. She had planned before he came in how she would tell him all the little events of her day, but now it seemed to her a long, dull story. "Oh, nothing," she said, with a gay little laugh. "Did you have a nice day?" "Why," he began, but his interest waned even as he started to speak. Besides, she was engrossed in breaking off a loose thread from the wool fringe of one of the pillows beside her. "Oh, pretty fair," he said. She could talk well enough to other people. Ernest, too, seemed to be talkative enough when he was with others. She tried to remember what they used to talk about before they were married, when they were engaged. It seemed to her that they never had had much to say to each other. But she hadn't worried about it then. Then, besides, there had been always kissing and things to take up your mind. And you can't depend on kisses and all the rest of it to while away the evenings after 7 years. You'd think that you would get used to it in 7 years, would realize that that was the way it was and let it go at that. You don't, though. A thing like that gets on your nerves. It isn't one of those cozy, companionable silences that people occasionally fall into together. It makes you feel as if you must do something about it, as if you weren't performing your duty. You have the feeling a hostess has when her party is going badly. Ernest would read industriously, and along toward the middle of the paper, he would start yawning aloud. Something happened inside Mrs. Weldon when he did this. She would murmur that she had to speak to Delia and hurry to the kitchen. She would stay there rather a long time, looking vaguely into jars and inquiring half-heartedly about laundry lists, and when she returned, he would have gone in to get ready for bed. In a year, 300 of their evenings were like this. 7 times 300 is more than 2,000. It is sometimes claimed this very silence is the sign of an intimacy deeper than any word, and obviously no one dreams of denying that conjugal life creates intimacy. This is true of all family relations, even those that include hatreds, jealousies, and resentments. Juan Doe strongly emphasizes the difference between this intimacy and a real human fraternity, writing, "Elise is my wife, and it is probable that none of my friends, none of the members of my family, not a single one of my own limbs, is more intimate with me than she. But however close to me is the place that she has made for herself and that I have made for her in my own most private universe, however deeply rooted she has become in the inextricable web of my body and soul, and there lies the whole mystery and the whole drama of our indissoluble union, the unknown person, whoever he may be, who happens to pass in the street at this particular moment and whom I can barely see from my window, is less of a stranger to me than she is." He says elsewhere, We discover that we are the victims of poisoning, but that we have grown used to it. How can we give it up without giving up ourselves? Still more. When I think of her, I feel that married love has nothing to do with sympathy, with sensuality, with passion, with friendship, or with love. It alone is adequate to itself and cannot be reduced to one or other of these different feelings. It has its own nature, its particular essence, and its unique mode, which depends on the couple that it brings together. Advocates of conjugal love readily admit it is not love, which is precisely what makes it marvelous. Note, there can be love within marriage, but then one does not speak of conjugal love. When these words are uttered, it means that love is missing. Likewise, when one says of a man that he is very communist, one means that he is not a communist. A great gentleman is a man who does not belong to the simple category of gentleman, and so on. For in recent years, the bourgeoisie has invented an epic style. Routine takes on the allure of adventure, faithfulness that of sublime madness, boredom becomes wisdom, and family hatreds are the deepest form of love. In truth, that two individuals hate each other without, however, being able to do without each other, is not at all the truest, the most moving of all human relations. It is one of the most pitiful. The ideal would be, on the contrary, that each human being, perfectly self-sufficient, be attached to another by the free consent of their love alone. Tolstoy admires the fact that the link between Natasha and Pierre is something indefinable but firm, solid, as was the union of his own soul with his body. If one accepts the dualist hypothesis, the body represents only a pure facticity for the soul. So in the conjugal union, each one would have for the other the inevitable weight of contingent fact. One would have to assume and love the other as an absurd and unchosen presence, as the necessary condition for and very matter of existence. There is a deliberate confusion between these two words, assuming and loving, and the mystification stems from this. One does not love what one assumes. One assumes one's body, past and present situation, but love is a movement toward an other, toward an existence separated from one's own, toward a finality, a future. The way to assume or take on a load or a tyranny is not to love it, but to revolt. A human relation has no value if it is lived in the immediacy. Children's relations with their parents, for example, only have value when they are reflected in a consciousness. One cannot admire conjugal relations that degenerate into the immediate, in which the spouses squander their freedom. One claims to respect this complex mixture of attachment, resentment, hatred, rules, resignation, laziness, and hypocrisy called conjugal love, only because it serves as an alibi. But what is true of friendship is true of physical love. For friendship to be authentic, it must first be free. Freedom does not mean whim. A feeling is a commitment that goes beyond the instant, but it is up to the individual alone to compare his general will to his personal behavior so as either to uphold his decision or, on the contrary, to break it. Feeling is free when it does not depend on any outside command, when it is lived in sincerity without fear. The message of conjugal love is an invitation, by contrast, to all kinds of repression and lies. And above all, it keeps the husband and wife from genuinely knowing each other. Daily intimacy creates neither understanding nor sympathy. The husband respects his wife too much to be interested in the metamorphoses of her psychological life. That would mean recognizing in her a secret autonomy that could prove to be bothersome, dangerous. Does she really get pleasure in bed? Does she really love her husband? Is she really happy to obey him? He prefers not to question himself. These questions even seem shocking to him. He married a good woman. By nature, she is virtuous, devoted, faithful, pure, and happy, and she thinks what she should think. A sick man, after thanking his friends, his family, and his nurses, says to his young wife, who for 6 months had not left his bedside, "I do not have to thank you. You merely did your duty. He gives her no credit for any of her good qualities. They are guaranteed by society. They are implied by the very institution of marriage. He does not notice that his wife does not come out of a book by Bonald, that she is an individual of flesh and blood. He takes for granted her faithfulness to the orders she imposes on herself. He takes no account of the fact that she might have temptations to overcome, that she might succumb to them, that in any case, her patience, her chastity, and her decency might be difficult conquests. He ignores even more completely her dreams, her fantasies, her nostalgia, and the emotional climate in which she spends her days. Thus, Chardon shows us in Eva a husband who has for years kept a journal of his conjugal life. He speaks of his wife with delicate nuances, but only of his wife as he sees her, as she is for him without ever giving her dimensions as a free individual. He is stunned when he suddenly learns she does not love him, that she is leaving him. One often speaks of the naive and loyal man's disillusionment in the face of feminine perfidy. The husbands in Bernstein are scandalized to discover that the women in their lives are fickle, mean, or adulterous. They take it with a virile courage. But the author does not fail to make them seem generous and strong. They seem more like boors to us, without sensitivity and goodwill. Man criticizes women for their duplicity, but he must be very complacent to let himself be duped with so much constancy. Woman is doomed to immorality because morality for her consists in embodying an inhuman entity, the strong woman, the admirable mother, the virtuous woman, and so on. As soon as she thinks, dreams, sleeps, desires, and aspires without orders, she betrays the masculine ideal. This is why so many women do not let themselves be themselves, except in their husband's absence. Likewise, the woman does not know her husband. She thinks she perceives his true face because she grasps it in its daily contingency. But the man is first what he does in the world among other men. Refusing to understand the movement of his transcendence is denaturing it. One marries a poet, says Elise, and when one is his wife, the first thing she notices is he forgets to flush the toilet. Note, Bold Chronicle of a Strange Marriage. He nevertheless remains a poet, and the wife who is not interested in his works knows him less than a remote reader. It is often not the wife's fault that this complicity is forbidden to her. She cannot share her husband's affairs. She lacks the experience and the necessary culture to follow him. She fails to join him in the projects that are far more essential for him than the monotonous repetition of everyday life. In certain privileged cases, the wife can succeed in becoming a real companion for her husband. She discusses his plans, gives him advice, participates in his work. But she is deluding herself if she thinks she can accomplish work of her own like that. He alone remains the active and responsible freedom. To find joy in serving him, she must love him. If not, she will experience only vexation because she will feel frustrated by the fruit of her efforts. Men, faithful to the advice given by Balzac to treat the wife as a slave while persuading her she is queen, exaggerate to the utmost the importance of the influence women wield. Deep down, they know well they are lying. Georgette Leblanc was duped by this mystification when she demanded of Maeterlinck that he write their two names on the book they had, or so she thought, written together. In the preface to the singer's Souvenirs, Grasset bluntly explains that any man is ready to hail the woman who shares his life as an associate and an inspiration, but that he nevertheless still regards his work as belonging to him alone, rightfully. In any action, any work, what counts is the moment of choice and decision. The wife generally plays the role of the crystal ball clairvoyants use. Another would do just as well. And the proof is that often the man welcomes another advisor, another collaborator, with the same confidence. Sophia Tolstoy copied her husband's manuscripts and put them in order. He later gave the job to one of his daughters. She understood that even her zeal had not made her indispensable. Only autonomous work can assure the wife an authentic autonomy. Note, there is sometimes a real collaboration between a man and a woman, in which the two are equally autonomous. In the Joliot-Curie couple, for example. But then the wife, who is as skilled as the husband, goes out of her wifely role. Their relation is no longer of a conjugal order. There are also wives who use the man to achieve personal aims. They escape the condition of the married woman. Conjugal life takes different forms depending on the case. But for many wives, the day begins approximately in the same way. The husband leaves his wife hurriedly in the morning. She is happy to hear the door close after him. She likes to find herself free, without duties, sovereign in her home. The children, in turn, leave for school. She will stay alone all day. The baby squirming in his crib or playing in his playpen is not company. She spends more or less time getting dressed, doing the housework. If she has a maid, she gives her instructions, lingers a little in the kitchen while chatting, or else she will stroll in the market, exchanging comments on the cost of living with her neighbors or shopkeepers. If her husband and children come home for lunch, she cannot take advantage of their presence very much. She has too much to do to get the meal ready, serve, and clean up. Most often, they do not come back for lunch. In any case, she has a long, empty afternoon in front of her. She takes her youngest children to the public park and knits or sews while keeping an eye on them. Or, sitting at the window at home, she does her mending. Her hands work, but her mind is not occupied. She ruminates over her worries. She makes plans. She daydreams. She is bored. None of her occupations suffices in itself. Her thoughts are directed toward her husband and her children, who will wear these shirts, who will eat the meal she is preparing. She lives for them alone. And are they at all grateful to her? Little by little, her boredom changes into impatience. She begins to wait for their return anxiously. The children come back from school. She kisses them, questions them, but they have homework to do. They want to have fun together. They escape. They are not a distraction. And then they have bad grades. They have lost a scarf. They are noisy, messy. They fight with each other. She almost always has to scold them. Their presence annoys the mother more than it soothes her. She waits for her husband more and more urgently. What is he doing? Why is he not home already? He has worked, seen the world, chatted with people. He has not thought of her. She starts ruminating nervously that she is stupid to sacrifice her youth to him. He is not grateful to her. The husband, making his way toward the house where his wife is closed up, feels vaguely guilty. Early in the marriage, he would bring a bunch of flowers, a little gift as an offering. But this ritual soon loses any meaning. Now he arrives empty-handed. And he is even less in a hurry when he anticipates the usual greeting. Indeed, the wife often takes revenge with a scene of boredom, of the daily wait. This is how she wards off the disappointment of a presence that does not satisfy the expectation of her waiting. Even if she does not express her grievances, her husband, too, is disappointed. He has not had a good time at his office. He is tired. He has a contradictory desire for stimulation and for rest. His wife's too familiar face does not free him from himself. He feels she would like to share his worries with him, that she also expects distraction and relaxation from him. Her presence weighs on him without satisfying him. He does not find real abandon with her. Nor do the children bring entertainment or peace. During the meal and the evening, there is a vague bad mood, reading, listening to the radio, chatting idly. Each one, under the cover of intimacy, will remain alone. Yet the wife wonders with an anxious hope, or a no less anxious apprehension, if tonight, finally, again, something will happen. She goes to sleep disappointed, irritated, or relieved. She will be happy to hear the door slam shut tomorrow. The lot of wives is even harsher if they are poor and overburdened with chores. It lightens when they have both leisure and distractions. But this pattern, boredom, waiting, and disappointment, is found in many cases. There are some escapes available to the wife, but in practice, they are not available to all. Note, refer to Chapter 7 of this volume. The chains of marriage are heavy, particularly in the provinces. A A wife has to find a way of coming to grips with a situation she cannot escape. Some, as we have seen, are puffed up with importance and become tyrannical matrons and shrews. Others take refuge in the role of the victim. They make themselves their husband's and children's pathetic slaves and find a masochistic joy in it. Others perpetuate the narcissistic behavior we have described in relation to the young girl. They also suffer from not realizing themselves in any undertaking and, being able to do nothing, they are nothing. Undefined, they feel undetermined and consider themselves misunderstood. They worship melancholy. They take refuge in dreams, play acting, illnesses, fads, scenes. They create problems around them or close themselves up in an imaginary world. The smiling Madame Baudet that Amiel depicted is one of these. Shut up in provincial monotony with a boorish husband, with no chance to act or to love, she is devoured by the feeling of her life's emptiness and uselessness. She tries to find compensation in romantic musings, in the flowers she surrounds herself with, in her clothes, her person. Her husband interferes even with these games. She ends up trying to kill him. The symbolic behavior into which the wife escapes can bring about perversions, and these obsessions can lead to crime. There are conjugal crimes dictated less by interest than by pure hatred. Thus, Mauriac shows us Thérèse d'Escherrouges trying to poison her husband as Madame Lafarge did previously. A 40-year-old woman who had endured an odious husband for 20 years was recently acquitted for having coldly strangled her husband with the help of her elder son. There had been no other way for her to free herself from an intolerable situation. For a wife who wants to live her situation in lucidity, in authenticity, her only resort is often to stoic pride. Because she is totally dependent, she can only have a deeply interior and therefore abstract freedom. She refuses ready-made principles and values. She judges, she questions, and thus escapes conjugal slavery. But her haughty reserve and her acceptance of the saying, "Suffer and be still," constitute no more than a negative attitude. Confined in denial, in cynicism, she lacks a positive use of her strength. As long as she is passionate and living, she finds ways to use it. She helps others, she consoles, protects, gives, she has many interests. But she suffers from not finding any truly demanding job, from not devoting her activity to an end. Often eaten away by loneliness and sterility, she ends up by giving up, destroying herself. Madame de Charrière provides us with a notable example of such a destiny. In the sympathetic book he devotes to her, Geoffrey Scott depicts her with a frond of flame, a frond of frost. Note, Geoffrey Scott, The Portrait of Zélide. But it is not her reason that put out this flame of life that Hermanche said could warm the heart of a Laplander. It is marriage that slowly assassinates the brilliant Belle de Zoilin. She resigned herself and called it reason. Either heroism or genius would have been necessary to invent a different outcome. That her lofty and rare qualities were not sufficient to save her is one of the most stunning condemnations of the conjugal institution found in history. Brilliant, cultivated, intelligent, and ardent, Mademoiselle de Zoilin astonished Europe. She frightened away suitors. She rejected more than 12 of them, but others, perhaps more acceptable, backed off. Hermanche was the only man who interested her, but it was out of the question to make him her husband. She carried on a 12-year correspondence with him, but this friendship and her studies no longer satisfied her. Virgin and martyr was a pleonasm, she said, and the constraints of Zoilin's life were unbearable. She wanted to become a woman, a free being. At 30, she married Monsieur de Charrière. She liked the honesty of heart she found in him, his sense of justice, and she first decided to make him the most tenderly loved husband in the world. Later, Benjamin Constant recounts that she had tormented him greatly to impress upon him reactions equal to hers. She did not manage to overcome his methodical impassivity. Shut up in Colombier with this honest and dull husband, a senile father-in-law, two dull sisters-in-law, Madame de Charrière began to be bored. The narrow-mindedness of Neufchâtel provincial society displeased her. She killed her days in washing the household linen and playing comet in the evening. A young man briefly crossed her life and left her lonelier than before. Taking ennui as muse, she wrote four novels on the customs of Neufchâtel, and the circle of her friends grew narrower. In one of her works, she described the long sadness of a marriage between a lively and sensitive woman and a good but ponderous and cold man. Conjugal life seemed to her like a chain of misunderstandings, disappointments, petty resentments. It was clear she herself was unhappy. She fell ill, recovered, returned to the long-accompanied solitude that was her life. It is clear that the routine of the life at Colombier and the negative, unresisting smoothness of her husband's temperament were like a perpetual pause which no activity of Madame de Charrière's could fill, writes her biographer. And then appears Benjamin Constant, who passionately occupied her for 8 years. When, too proud to wrest him from Madame de Stael, she gave him up, her pride hardened. She wrote to him one day, "The stay at Colombier was abhorrent to me, and I never went back there without despair. I decided not to leave it any more and made it bearable for myself." She closed herself up there and did not leave her garden for 15 years. This is how she applied the Stoic precept, "Seek to conquer one's heart rather than fortune." As a prisoner, she could only find freedom by choosing her prison. She accepted Monsieur de Charrière at her side as she accepted the Alps, says Scott. But she was too lucid not to understand that this resignation was, after all, only deception. She became so withdrawn, so hard, she was thought to be so despairing that she was frightening. She had opened her house to the immigrants who were pouring into Neufchâtel. She protected them, helped them, guided them. She wrote elegant and disillusioned works that Huber, a poor German philosopher, translated. She lavished advice on a circle of young women and taught Locke to her favorite one, Henriette. She loved to play the role of divine protection for the peasants of the area, avoiding Neufchâtel society more and more carefully. She preciously limited her life. She sought only to create routine and to endure it. Even her infinite acts of kindness had something frightening about them. In the chill of her self-control, she seemed to those around her like one moving in an empty room. On rare occasions, a visit, for example, the flame of life awakened. But the years passed aridly. Aging side by side lived Monsieur and Madame de Charrière, a whole universe apart, and often a visitor would turn from the house with relief, and hearing the gate clang behind him, would feel that he was leaving a shut tomb. The clock ticked. Monsieur de Charrière sat below alone, poring over his mathematics. Rhythmically, from the barn outside, came the sound of the threshers. It throbbed, and it ceased. Life went on, though it was threshed out. A life of small things, desperately compelled to fill every crevice of the day. To this Zélide, who hated littleness, had come. One might say Monsieur de Charrière's life was no livelier than his wife's. At least he had chosen it, and it seems it suited his mediocrity. If one imagines a man endowed with the exceptional qualities of the Belle de Zoylan, he surely would not be consumed in Colombier's arid solitude. He would have carved out a place for himself in the world, where he would undertake things, fight, act, and live. How many wives swallowed up in marriage have been, in Stendhal's words, lost to humanity? It is said marriage diminishes man. It is often true, but it almost always destroys woman. Marcel Prévost, advocate of marriage, admits it himself. "How many times have I met, after a few months or years of marriage, a young woman I had known as a girl and been struck by the ordinariness of her character, the meaninglessness of her life." Sophia Tolstoy uses almost the same words 6 months after her marriage. December 23, 1863. "My life is so mundane, and my death. But he has such a rich internal life, talent, and immortality." Note: Diaries of Sophia Tolstoy. Discrepancy between the French and the English translations. In the English text, the date is given as November 13, 1863. Translation. A few months earlier, she had uttered another complaint. May 9, 1863. You simply cannot be happy just sitting there sewing or playing the piano alone, completely alone, and gradually realizing, or rather becoming convinced, that even though your husband may not love you, you are stuck there forever, and there you must sit. 12 years later, she writes these words that many women today subscribe to. October 22, 1875. Day after day, month after month, year after year, nothing ever changes. I wake up in the morning and just lie there wondering who will get me up, who is waiting for me. The cook is bound to come in, then the nurse, so then I get up and sit silently darning holes, and then it's time for the children's grammar and piano lessons, then in the evening more darning, with Auntie and Lievochka playing endless games of patience. Note, discrepancy between the French and English translations. In the English text, the date is given as October 12, 1863. Translation. Madame Prudhon's complaint resonates with the same sound. You have your ideas, she said to her husband. And I, when you are at work, when the children are in school, I have nothing. In the first years, the wife often lulls herself with illusions. She tries to admire her husband unconditionally, to love him unreservedly, to feel she is indispensable to him and her children. And then her true feelings emerge. She sees her husband can get along without her, that her children are made to break away from her. They are always more or less thankless. The home no longer protects her from her empty freedom. She finds herself alone, abandoned, a subject, and she finds nothing to do with herself. Affections and habits can still be of great help, but not salvation. All sincere women writers have noted this melancholy that inhabits the heart of 30-year-old women. This is a characteristic common to the heroines of Catherine Mansfield, Dorothy Parker, and Virginia Woolf. Cécile Sauvage, who sang so gaily of marriage and children at the beginning of her life, later expresses a subtle distress. It is noteworthy that the number of single women who commit suicide, compared with married women, shows that the latter are solidly protected from revulsion against life between 20 and 30 years of age, especially between 25 and 30, but not in the following years. As for marriage, writes Albvox, it protects provincial as well as Parisian women until 30 years of age, but not after. Note, les causes du suicide, the causes of suicide. The comment applies to France and Switzerland, but not to Hungary or Oldenburg. The drama of marriage is not that it does not guarantee the wife the promised happiness. There is no guarantee of happiness. It is that it mutilates her. It dooms her to repetition and routine. The first 20 years of a woman's life are extraordinarily rich. She experiences menstruation, sexuality, marriage, and motherhood. She discovers the world and her destiny. She is mistress of a home at 20, linked from then on to one man, a child in her arms. Now her life is finished forever. Real activity, real work, are the privilege of man. Her only occupations are sometimes exhausting, but never fulfill her. Renunciation and devotion have been extolled, but it often seems highly futile to devote herself to the upkeep of any two beings until the end of their lives. It is all very grand to forget oneself, but one must know for whom and for what. Worst of all is that her devotion itself is exasperating. In her husband's eyes, it changes into a tyranny from which he tries to escape. And yet it is he who imposes his presence on woman as her supreme one justification. By marrying her, he obliges her to give herself to him completely. He does not accept the reciprocal obligation, which is to accept this gift. Sophia Tolstoy's words, "I live through him and for him. I demand the same thing from me," are certainly revolting, but Tolstoy demanded she only live for him and through him, an attitude reciprocity alone can justify. It is the husband's duplicity that dooms the wife to a misfortune of which he later complains to be the victim. Just as he wants her both hot and cold in bed, he claims her totally given and yet weightless. He asks her to fix him to earth and to let him be free, to ensure the daily monotonous repetition and not to bother him. Always to be present and never nag him. He wants her entirely for himself and not to belong to him. To live in a couple and to remain alone. Thus, as soon as he marries her, he mystifies her. She spends her life measuring the extent of this betrayal. What D.H. Lawrence says about sexual love is generally valid. The union of two human beings is doomed to failure if it requires an effort for each of them to complete each other, which supposes a primal mutilation. Marriage must combine two autonomous existences, not be a withdrawal, an annexation, an escape, a remedy. This is what Nora understands when she decides that before being able to be a wife and mother, she has to be a person. Note, Ibsen, A Doll's House. The couple should not consider itself a community, a closed cell. Instead, the individual as individual has to be integrated into a society in which he can thrive without assistance. He will then be able to create links in pure generosity with another individual equally adapted to the group. Links founded on the recognition of two freedoms. This balanced couple is not a utopia. Such couples exist sometimes even within marriage, more often outside of it. Some are united by a great sexual love that leaves them free in their friendships and occupations. Others are linked by a friendship that does not hamper their sexual freedom. More rarely, there are still others who are both lovers and friends, but without seeking in each other their exclusive reason for living. Many nuances are possible in the relations of a man and a woman, in companionship, pleasure, confidence, tenderness, complicity, and love.